are in Perektet in chapter 9. And is, as with all the chapters, a lot going on. What I want to do today is to focus on the war, the way that they fought the war, and some of the things that are often said about the way that war went, which when you look at the text, you realize are not accurate. And then second, this mitzvah of mishloach manot matanot la'ev yonim, why are we sending gifts for Purim? And a couple of ideas within that. I also gave you a link, or two links, really, in the end of the sheet, about the convoluted acceptance of this celebration. It's incredibly hard to unravel the end of chapter 9, because Mordechai said, well, take a look at the beginning of the sheet and you'll see the problem. The chapter begins with the anticipation of a Jewish victory. Remember that chapter 8 ended with Mordechai being elevated and all the nations are afraid. So the chapter begins with an anticipation of a Jewish victory. Then you get their military success and the hanging of Haman's sons. And then Esther asks for the battle to be extended a day in Shushan. You have the battle and the celebration in Shushan and beyond. That's a spontaneous celebration. That's not an instruction. And then you get Mordechai promoting the holiday. Then you get a recap of the story, and you're told again the Jews accepted it, kimu v'kiblu. And then after that, Esther sends letters to everybody again promoting the holiday. Why do you need that second set of letters, which Mordechai incidentally is involved with as well? So it becomes very complicated, and there are a lot of different explanations. And Professor Yonatan Grossman wrote two articles on this. They are in Hebrew, but for anyone who wants to read them, I gave you the links at the end of the sheet, just because we would need most of a single hour just to go through that. And there are too many other things that we need to talk about. So, again, we're starting by talking about the war. In general, the themes of this chapter are Jewish military ethics, in terms of the way they fight the war, and the unity theme of Esther, which we're going to look at in Mishloach Manot. So, I brought you one source, in source number one, of many that I could have brought. Meaning, the way I came to this source, which is an article in the New York Times from 1989, was just by Googling something like Esther War Bloodthirsty, or something like that. You can find it all over the place. The allegation that Megillas Esther is promoting bloodshed. Take a look at source number one. This article from 1989 was a review of a movie by an Israeli director, Amos Gitai. Amos Gitai's film Esther faithfully retells the familiar biblical story celebrated in the Jewish festival of Purim, but gives it a sharp contemporary resonance. In the tale, Ahasuerus, the ruler of a kingdom stretching from India to Ethiopia, chooses as his new queen Esther, the beautiful niece of Mordechai, who once prevented his assassination, which... the story's backward. The preventing of the assassination was after, nonetheless. When Haman, the prime minister, reports that Mordechai refused to prostrate himself before him, he is given the authority to order the extermination of all the Jews in the kingdom in a single day. And yes, that's another mistake. He never tells Ahasuerus that he's destroying Mordechai's nation, and he never tells Ahasuerus it's about not bowing to him. Nonetheless, that's not the point either. Mordechai entreats Esther, whom he had once charged not to reveal her Jewish descent, to call upon the king to rescind the orders. She succeeds brilliantly, the plans are canceled, and Haman is hanged on the scaffold that had been built for Mordechai. Okay. What is often omitted or downplayed in the tale, and what the film underscores, is the story's brutal ending, in which the Jews were given permission to massacre their enemies on the day that was to have been their annihilation. At Esther's request, they were even granted an extra day of revenge. With its theme of vindictive retaliation emphasized, the story foreshadows the cycles of escalating revenge and reprisal that keep the Middle East boiling. So, not only is the Book of Esther bloodthirsty, but apparently it's also responsible for keeping the Middle East boiling for thousands of years. If not for that Book of Esther, you know, everything would be just wonderful. Now I understand that, you know, you should give a copy of this to some of the negotiators. But this isn't, like I said, this is not rare. You can look for this everywhere and you will find people saying this. And the reality is that the text, when you actually read the Megillah, says otherwise. Some of you, I think, may have been there. We did, my Beit Midrash used to do something called Shir Theater on our Shabbat Tonim, where we would have a play that was about a theme from the Parsha or from the Torah in general. We did them primarily at Shari Shemayim. We did them in a few other shuls as well. And the one that we did at Shari Shemayim was right before Purim. And it was about this. It was about exactly this. And the question of just how bloodthirsty the war was. I actually really liked that one. That was one of our better ones. In there, we took a look at the text a lot more closely. Take a look, first of all, at chapter 8, sentences 5 to 8. And this we already know. We talked about this last week, but it's a necessary starting point. By the way, since I see quite a few gray boxes, I have to send to you what Chana sent me. Rav Bazak from the Gush published a poem about blank screens on Zoom. It's very, very funny. He's clearly frustrated by it. It was very good. So I have to send that out if I remember. But anyway, taking a look at chapter 8, sentences 5 to 8, right? This was Esther's original plea to Ahasuerus. Did she ask for the opportunity to kill anyone? No. What did she do? What does she want? I mean, you know. Susan, you're muted.
Rescind.
No. Chapter 8, sentence 5.
He wants him to rescind the decree.
Yeah, rescind the decree, right? We had this whole discussion about whether Ahasuerus was making it up when he said, I can't rescind the decree. And the evidence from Ezra, the evidence from Daniel. But we weren't looking for a battle at all. We just said, leave us alone. So that's their first stop in this regard. Frankly, there it does echo the modern Middle East, right? We're just asking them to leave us alone. And they're insisting you have to fight. Like, come on. But let's move ahead. Take a look, please. Yeah. Bidyuk. We just wanted them to take back the decree, and that was all it was. Number two. Take a look at chapter 8, sentence 11. This is the royal order licensing the Jews to basically do whatever they want. La'ashmid, la'harog, u'la'abed, right? Echoing the language of Haman, which we're going to come back to. But to destroy, to kill, to eliminate all of the forces of those who were besieging them, taf v'nashim, children and women, u'shlalam lavoz, and to take spoils. Right? That's the license that is actually given to them. Now take a look at chapter 9, sentence 10. This is the general report of what has actually happened right after the hanging of the 10 sons of Haman, which we're going to talk about as well. So we're told, Uvabiza lo shalchu et yadam. They did not send their hands against the spoils. And then again, look in sentence 15. This is the report from Shushan of what has happened. Uva biza lo shalchu et yadam. They did not take spoils when they fought in Shushan. And then again, in sentence 16, when we talk about what happened in all the other lands, once again, uva biza lo shalchu et yadam. They did not send their hands against the spoils. Right? Three times the text makes sure to tell us this. And if you take a look at the source sheet, look at Rashi in source number 3. Ushlalam lavoz. The decree says that they can take spoils. Rashi says, Kasher nechtav barishonot, as was recorded in the first letters, the letters of Haman, that that those who were attacking the Jews could take spoils. Vehem babiza lo shalchu et yadam, but they did not send their hands against the spoil. Sheheru lakol shalo nasa l'shem mamon. They show that they're not doing this for the sake of taking property. But more than that, we read in chapter 8, sentence 11, that the decree allowed them to attack their enemies and the children and the women. But when you look at what they actually did, it doesn't play out that way. Take a look at chapter 9, sentence 2, please. Chapter 9, Jeanette, you're having trouble with your speaker, I think.
I just didn't hear.
Chapter 9, sentence 2. And if you look at the sheet at source number 2, you'll see it there next to targets. That wasn't a reference to stores in the U.S. If you take a look at chapter 9, sentence 2, you're told that the Jews gathered, right? The Ish lo amad bifnei, the Jews gathered in their cities in all of the lands of King Ahasuerus, lishloach yad bimevakshei ra'atam, to send their hand against whom? Those who wanted to harm them. And that is repeated. Take a look at sentence 5. In sentence 5, we're told who they struck. Vayaku ayehudim bichol oyeveihem. They struck those who were their oyevim, who were their enemies. And then once again, in sentence 15, sentence 16, and yes, Jeanette, your note in the chat is correct, but if you look at sentence 15 and sentence 16, we're told that they gathered in Shushan on the 14th, and they killed 300 men, and they didn't take the spoils. And then in sentence 16, we're told they gathered va'amod al nafsham, as Jeanette notes, to stand for their lives, v'noach me oyveihem, for relief from their oyevim, the enemies. V'harog bisona ahem, and they killed those who hated them. They're killing those who attacked them, so much so that Malbim thinks that must have been Ahasuerus' order. Take a look on your sheet at source number 4. Malbim is going to make 2 points here. He's going to talk about the original order of Ahasuerus, and he's also going to define oyev and sone, because that's a very Malbim thing to do. So take a look. He says, hine. Vaday lo haya harishut netuna leYehudim laharog et kol mi sheyirtzu. He says, there's no way the Jews are given permission to kill whoever they want. Ahasuerus, I don't care what the decree said, Ahasuerus is not licensing them to kill out whoever they want in his kingdom. Ki lo era ketuv ba'sfarim rak lihina kem mitzorirehem. Because the original decree in the Sfarim, the original decree said, specifically, those who were attacking them in chapter 8, sentence 11, right before it said women and children, it said the tzorerim. Ve'achar ki ata ish lo amad bifnehem ba'akrachim agdolim. And now that nobody stood before them, in the big cities, lo hayu hargim rak ha'oyvim she'evasam al ha'yudim haya mefursam shu magzimim lahara lahem. So they only struck those whose enmity was open, the oyevim. And I see your hand, Rebecca. They only struck those who were known. In other words, you go out to fight this war, there's no one standing before you, so who do you kill? Only those who were known as oyevim, those who had been the ones who were trying to harm us in the first place. The shayu magzimim lahara lahem, the word guzma, we use to mean exaggeration. Here, I think it must mean threat. I don't think it means exaggerating, because that would not fit the context at all. Avaloat ha-sona'im, they did not kill the sona'im. And he notes in parentheses, ha'evdel bein oyev v'sone, sha'oyev evato geluya, v'sone ein sinato geluya. The difference between oyev and sone, between oyev and sone, is that an oyev hates you openly. A sone is somebody whose enmity is not exposed. All they did with the sonim was vayasu b'sonehem kirt sonam. They did what they wanted to the sonim. Shayicholim laganot otam lahashpilam. They could diminish them, but they did not kill them. They did not attack them. So says Malbim. Malbim argues that the king was not allowing us to do anything else to broadly, only to attack those who were our enemies. That's his belief. Now, frankly, he's missing one point, and I think it's an important one, which is that in sentence 16, it actually says, v'harog b'sona ahem. So I think, I, I'm sorry, but I think the Malbim just missed it. I think that's just a mistake. But his suggestion overall is consistent with what we see in the Psukim, with what we see in these verses, which is they're attacking those who are their enemies. They're not attacking broadly, wantonly anybody they choose. Now, Rebecca had her hand up and she was waiting, but then she had to step away. So, anybody else have a question or a comment on this while we wait for Rebecca? Yeah, Hana? But you're muted.
Looks to me like I agree with Malbim, but it's much more obvious from the word, because Soneh, I can hate whoever, but I'm not out to harm them.
Right.
Not like them. But Oyeh means I'm openly, I'm ready to do anything to them.
That's could be. I mean, we certainly...
language,
right.
But he's right, yeah.
Right. I mean, that's true. We use the word Oyeh to describe an act, that's involved, whereas Soneh is usually emotion-oriented. I hear that, or motivation-oriented. Rebecca?
I'm sorry, I had to answer the door. So
no, thank you for your patience.
I think what's always bothered me a little bit is the issue of Nehem, to me, sounds like they were not experiencing a pushback. They were not experiencing an offensive, like an effect from their enemies. So the question is, are we assuming it's a rodent kind of situation? I don't know. It doesn't sound like it to me.
So good.
So I'm wondering how they can justify
right.
the killing.
So the answer is coming. I had that question in my notes as well. How do you even know who to attack, especially the Sonim, who have never expressed it? Not only are they not expressing it today, but they've never expressed it. So how do you know? Professor Grossman has a brilliant idea, which I think answers this. So hang in there. Chana, you were going to say?
Yeah, I think that also Hashem said to Yeshua, lo yamod ish befamicha. It doesn't mean that you're not going to fight them. They're not going to win. So lo yamod ish means that they weren't able to overcome.
Right, you could suggest that. You could suggest ish lo amad bifneihem simply means that no one successfully opposed them, as opposed to that nobody stood against them. Malbim clearly doesn't think so. Right? Malbim is not of that frame of mind, but I hear that you could say it. But I want to ask a different question first. Yes, Janine.
Couldn't they just be different people? Some stayed in their homes, or there were onlookers, and some people were actively fighting. I mean, the people that were killed could have been the second one.
The problem is that the wording is v'ish lo amad bifneihem,
exactly.
Which the way Malbim understands it means no one is even opposing them. Right? Not only, not no one is opposing successfully, but the way he reads it is no one is opposing them. Which again, then how did you know who to kill? And why are you killing them? So again, we're going to come back to it. I really like Grossman's idea. It's very funny because sometimes I read it, well not sometimes, often, I'll read an article on something where I already have my thoughts and I've already done my research and I feel like, I'm going to read it just to see, but I basically know where I want to go. And this topic is very much like that. And then I read him and I was like, wow, I never thought about that. He has something outstanding to add to it. And speaking of outstanding, Moish.
Well, I think everybody's missing something. What else is new? He totally misses the Ish. And that's the key. Ish means a distinguished, respectable, important person. All of the leaders of the provinces and all their buddies wanted to stay in bed with Ahasuerus. They stayed out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people who stayed out of it.
It's an interesting idea.
Who knew they were getting trouble, they fought back. And by the way, there's nothing here about the number of Jews who were killed as opposed to some other places. There's obviously a reason for that. There was an argument as to whether the number who were killed were enough to justify the number of evil people who were killed. That's why you don't see the number at all.
Right, so we're going to... It's an interesting possibility for sure. It's an interesting possibility for sure. But I want to address a couple of things here that I think really, really we need to address. First, basic question here. If you're not planning on killing women and children, why did you get licensed to do it? right? Why does your decree say that?
But why are you assuming that it's only males that are their enemies?
Because you included Taf, you included children.
As they were included in the decree against the... I mean, I'm playing devil's
advocate. But what you're saying is correct. What you're saying, I think, is...
against Jews, and, so it almost becomes
what you're saying is correct. Meaning, Malbim says this, and I've even seen it, I think I saw it in Rashi as well, that it was in the Rashi that I brought you in source number 3. The second decree is kasher nechtav barishonot. It's as was recorded in the first one. So the first decree, the decree of Haman, said, ushlalam lavoz, therefore this one says, ushlalam lavoz. The second decree said, the first decree said, Taf v'nashim, women and children, therefore the second one says it as well. But now I want to get to the death toll. 75,000 people around the empire, right? Take a look at chapter 9, sentences 12 to 16. And you see it over there. We're told that the count comes before Ahasuerus. Right? He has 500 dead in Shushan. Where am I looking? Yes, he has Hargua Yudim Vabet Chamesh Meos Ish. You have 500 plus the sons of Haman. I want to come back to them. Getting killed in Shushan. And where am I missing? Hang on.
It's 75,000, I think, elsewhere.
Yeah, I'm just looking for it. It's in sentence 16, at the end of the section that I noted. So Chamisha V'Shivim Aleph. 75,000 in the kingdom as a whole. So, where does that come from? How do you justify killing 75,000 people? So, you could note, as we did before, that these are supposed to be Mevakshei Ra'atam, Oyvim, Sonim. The text emphasizes that there are people that don't like us. But Professor Grossman, in an article called Ha'im Tevach Lalo Havchana, has this very creative idea, which I already referenced. He notes two interesting questions in the text. Number one, and I actually asked this question earlier this year, why is everybody afraid of us? Meaning the text that we read last week when we talked about the Mityahadim said everybody was afraid of the Jews. Whether that means they converted or pretended to be our allies or pretended to be ethnically Jewish, all the different explanations we gave for Mityahadim, they're all afraid of us. Why should they be afraid of us? You're 127 nations. The Jews have been given license to defend themselves. Oh no, here come the Jews. Like, what are you afraid of? There are still way, way more of them than there are of us. Rebecca and then Chana.
I think we see that anybody who opposes the king is dead. And now Mordechai and Esther, who now are out of the closet Jews, are in.
Mm-hmm.
And you oppose them, and there is something to, this is not, there isn't trial by trial here, it's just, you're off and you're killed.
So that could be, but I have something to add to that. It's a reasonable read, but there's something more going on. Chana?
I think it's all the idea of Esther Panim, same as Yaakov and Shechem. Why would they be afraid of Yaakov? Because Hashem gave them
right. You could definitely take that and say that it's that Hashem is doing it, and it's simply supernatural. You can give that approach, but I got another point.
When she said "im yudim" as right. So you don't have any chance to survive.
Right. So Ruchama points out Zeresh and her response after Mordechai is on parade, and we gave two different explanations for why Zeresh thinks this, whether you're talking about the practical, rational side of the Megillah, and just that she sees Haman's plan to have Mordechai hung as a traitor now has a problem because Mordechai is proclaimed to be loyal to the king, or whether it's because the whole thing was religious in the first place, like the lottery was religious, and she has this belief that the nation from Yehud poses a danger. Either way, but I'm gonna show you something here. Susan, you were gonna say?
I was gonna say that it looks to me like if you take the practical again,
Mordechai now has the king's backing.
Yeah.
It's not that they're afraid of just the Jews. They're afraid that Ahasuerus said, go ahead and do it. You have the backing of the king. That's a lot more scary than just the Jews.
Right. No, along the lines of what Rebecca had said, this is not a king who tolerates his enemies. And if he's decided that Mordechai is his second in command, anybody who's against Mordechai is in trouble. And I think you could say that, but I think there's more. Take a look, please, at chapter 8, sentence 17, and tell me, who are they afraid of? Who are the nations afraid of in chapter 8, sentence 17? It says it. It's not a trick question. Yeah, who are they afraid of? Sorry, Ellen, you got to unmute. No, who are they afraid of?
It says here the Jews.
The Jews. Pachad HaYehudim.
The fear of the Jews was upon them.
Yeah, they're afraid of the Jews. That was easy. Now take a look at chapter 9, sentence 2, and tell me, who are they afraid of? They're afraid of the Jews. Pachdam, right? The pachad of them. Them being, the antecedent is HaYehudim, the Jews. So far, so good. This was easy. That was 2. Now look at the third one, chapter 9, sentence 3, and tell me who they're afraid of. Sorry, Alina, what? You're muted.
Mordechai.
Yeah. They're afraid of Mordechai. What happened? They were afraid of the Jews, they're afraid of the Jews, and now they're afraid of Mordechai. Something is different here. So this is where Grossman takes his stand. Take a look at source number 5, please, on your sheet. And it's a lot of text in the Hebrew, so I'm just going to read my English translation aloud, but you can see the original there as well. Was Mordechai not appointed as the new official over Haman's office? In this office were found the plans for the destruction, lists of those who helped and supported in every city, and the locations of the ammunition stores. More important, Mordechai's appointment to Haman's authority made him the new official over the royal army, which could become involved during the battle on either side. Logically, a more precise description of these events would depict them as a targeted killing. In that ellipsis, what I skipped is where he talks about those who say that it was a bloody war and it was a massacre and it was all sorts of things. He says, a more precise description of these events would depict them as a targeted killing, albeit over a broad area. Since Mordechai had access to the lists Haman had prepared in advance, and since he knew where Haman's men were hiding, the general expression of those who sought to harm them, Mevakshei Ra'atam, had a specific address. Jewish fighters, and presumably part of the Persian army under Mordechai's control, received precise guidance, and it is certainly possible that they sought specific men who were Haman's right hand during his campaign of destruction. It is then also clear why Esther sought to extend the search and targeted killing for another day in Shushan. Based on information Mordechai had collected, there were more enemies of the Jews, which they had not succeeded in reaching on the first day. Logically, Haman had many supporters in Shushan beyond his 10 sons, and logically, they were now hiding in various shelters. Esther sought to find them at this opportunity made available to the Jews. Those 300 who were hiding were found and killed on the second day of fighting. Once he says it, it makes a lot of sense. I have to admit, I never thought of Haman as being organized. It just wasn't like, it was like, okay, I issued a decree, the Jews are going to get killed, however it happens, whatever the mechanics are going to be. But what he's saying makes sense, in that if Haman really wants to see the Jews destroyed, he's not just going to have an order issued, everybody go out and kill Jews on that day. He's going to make sure that it happens. And Mordechai now has access to all of the records. You overran the bunker, so to speak. And now you know where everybody is hiding. And that, to apply that idea here, I have to admit, having some reluctance on it, Rebecca, my point wasn't about Mordechai being organized. My point was about Haman being organized. Yeah. Mordechai, I assumed, was organized. But he uses this idea to explain the fact that you have a census. Right? They're able to report the very next day, or not even the next day, that day. Right? They're able to give a report of numbers to Ahasuerus same day? That seems absurd. How in the world are you giving, I mean, over that area without telecommunications? How in the world are you reporting in that day we killed X number of people? What does it even mean? The answer is because they had a list. And they just went down the list. That answers the question of how they knew whom to attack if no one is standing before them and if the Sonim are in hiding, right? The answer is that they knew because they had the records. Yes, Moish. You're muted.
There we go. Okay. When you mentioned those three psukim about Nafal Pachad, it's worth noting that the first one has Pachad Hayudi, and the third one has Pachad Mordechai, and the second one, which stands out on its own, says Pachdam.
Right, which the antecedent is Yehudim.
I don't know what the answer is. I don't know what the answer is, but it's obviously instructive that that's was done. As to Haman, I think that it will take a long time to discuss this. Haman has been planning this from the beginning. He's been planning it from the Mishnah. He's in page one.
Okay. I'm still not sold on that idea, but okay.
Okay. That's fine.
Hana.
Longer time for you to think about it.
Yes, Hana.
I think it's when Esther gives Mordechai permission, she doesn't put him in the Bet Haman, but Al Bet Haman, which means overseeing something. So it sort of lends itself to know that there's something to see. List, I guess.
Right. That's interesting. It's an interesting possibility for sure. So I want to turn to one other aspect here, which is the hanging of Haman's sons. What is that about? So the easy explanation is they are being hanged just like everybody else who's hanged in the Megillah as traitors to the throne. Meaning Bigtan and Teresh were hanged. Mordechai was supposed to be hanged, and we suggested that that was the argument that he was a traitor to Ahasuerus. So now that happens to them. Rashi brings you a medrash from Seder Olam, which suggests that they are actually the Kotvei Sitna. If you remember Ezra chapter 4, which we've talked about a little bit, we talked about it when we talked about we talked about it a couple of times, really. But these are the people who put a halt to the construction of the Beis HaMikdash by writing a letter to the Persian king saying that the Jews are trying to build their defenses and then they're not going to pay taxes and all of that. So that story, based on the chronology we presented in the beginning of the year, that story is before this. This is, I agree with you, Rebecca. I think that it's distant. However, it would support Moish, so Moish will like it. The idea that Haman's family is opposed to the Jews before the Megillah ever begins. The idea that Haman's sons would have been those who did this. You can find some support for it. There are things you can say in support of it. But what I wanted to show you, whether you take the view that it's just the being hanged as traitors or whether you take the view that they actually had a role against the Jews before, and either way, I wanted to call your attention to the way that it's written in the Megillah. Right? Hopefully your editions, whether they have an English translation, no English translation, doesn't matter. Hopefully your editions show the way that it's written. Is it written in two columns? Right? Ve'et and the name. Ve'et and the name. Ve'et and the name. Right? It's always a challenge when you lay in Megillah. You're supposed to lay in every single word out of the cloth. So that means you have to see the right ve'et each time. So when I read it through the Megillah, I'll keep one hand on the ve'et and one hand on the names. And ve'et prashandasa, ve'et dalfon, ve'et asata, ve'et parata, ve'et adali, ve'et aridata. You know, you have to go down the list reading all the Ve'etz correctly. But what I wanted to highlight is Yehoshua chapter 12, which I gave you the reference to in source number 6. So if you have a Tanakh with you, take a look at Yehoshua chapter 12 and tell me what you see, please. It's on your sheet in source number 6.
Oh, 9. It's written the same way. At Melech Yericho, and God Melech.
Yes. The kings Yehoshua defeats are recorded in the same way. Why is that? There and here.
Could it be for emphasis? It really sticks out in your mind.
It does. It does. But they don't really seem to be like the highlight of the Megillah. I mean, the sons of Haman are making their first and last appearance here.
But it's the death of them, like this one and this one and this one. You really feel it.
Right.
You're rooting out the foundation, you know, you're rooting out everything that Haman was, as well as the, you know, the foundation, the children, like, you know, like as we said on Shabbat, we are...
Right, this is Zecher Amalek. Right, I think you could say that for sure. I want to show you two ideas, and then I'll take your hand, Moish. Take a look on your sheet, please, at source number 7, the Gemara and Megillah commenting on this. Kol hashirot kulan, whenever you have biblical poems, they are nichtavot ariach agabe leveina, uleveina agabe ariach. They are written with half brick atop full brick and full brick atop half brick. And what that means is, if you think of the song at the sea, Az Yashir, the way that it's written in a Sefer Torah is you have first the top, you have something in the middle, and then you have two below it, one on either side, and then something in the middle, and then two below it on either side. It's a wall, essentially. It's meant to be a wall structure, but not like prose. There are gaps. There are all sorts of explanations for the gaps, but there are gaps in it. Chutz mishirazu, the Gemara says, except for this one, meaning Haman, and Malchei Canaan, the kings of Canaan we just saw in Yehoshua. Sha'ariach agabe ariach uleveina agabe leveina. Half brick, full brick atop, full brick. Meaning, it's just a tower on the right side and a tower on the left side. My time, a why? Shalote tikumalama palatan. Because once they fall, they can't come back up. There's nothing to climb up once they collapse. They should not be able to return. And I think that supports what Rebecca said, that it's about the Zecher Amalek. It's about getting rid of the memory of Amalek. They should never be able to return. But at its core, and then I'll take your question, Moish. At its core, what this is a name list. Those who were there when we did Ezra and Nehemiah will remember we had a lot of discussions about name lists in Tanakh. Tanakh loves, and in particular in this era, this point in history, loves lists of names. It's a celebration of what Hashem did for us. So you celebrate by writing this poem, which has a nice rhythm to it. But that's what's going on here. So I guess what I'm trying to say is this stands out. It's odd because we don't know them before, and yet we're making this poem about them. Rashi gives us one explanation from the Medrash that they are actually enemies we've seen elsewhere. It could be it's the Zecher Amalek idea, the memory of Amalek, or it could just be this makes for a good poem. A good celebration poem to thank Hashem. Moish, what are you going to tell me?
I am going to blow everybody's mind.
Again?
I just thought about this, and this is so right. The answer is in Pasuk 13. This is the 10 sons on the tree, hanging.
Yeah.
The tree is on the left side. Each guy, they put all 10 of them on that one tree. This is the same tree that Haman was hung on. And that's why it looks exactly like a hanging tree.
Well, Haman was hanged there a year ago.
I'm not disagreeing with that. But if you look, the Esther asked for them to be hanged. Al-Ha'itz. If you go entire Megillah, without exception, Pot 8 is only that tree. The tree that Beit HaNan Teresh is, or Hagon, is 8. It's not the same tree. It's only that same piece. In other words, Haman had a great idea. Yeah, you gotta hang all these people up where everybody can see them. And look at it, it's so obvious.
Right, the shape of a gallows. It could be. The gallows shape.
They're all on one tree. They're all on one tree. That's what Esther asked for. All on one tree.
Right. I will note, though, just so we're clear, the text seems to indicate that they're already dead. Meaning, they were killed. I'm just saying, they're not being hanged. It's not an execution. It's a display. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. So, this is all just in terms of the war, the conduct of the war. I want to shift gears now to talk about Mishloach Manot and Matanot La'Evyonim. Okay? The gifts that we send, gifts, portions of food, and gifts to the needy as well. And I think, going back to what we said in week one, that this book is supposed to be a book of exile, it provides an important lesson for the Jews in exile, specifically unity, and unity in helping others to live as Jews. And I'll explain what I mean, obviously. Take a look at chapter 9, sentence 19, please. This is before Mordecai and Esther have sent any scrolls about what the celebration ought to be. This is spontaneous. So the Jews living in the open areas, in the open cities, I'm going to skip the significance of the open cities term. It's an interesting question, but not for right now. They make the 14th day of Adar, Simcha u'mishtev yom tov, a day of joy, a day of feasting, a day that is a yom tov. Yom Tov is an expression we find in different contexts. It doesn't necessarily mean Yantif, you know, no malacha. That's not necessarily what we're talking about. Umishloach manot ish l're'ehu. And sending portions to each other. And then in sentence 22, you get Mordechai's instruction for how to celebrate this. Not just now, but in the future. B'chol shana v'shana. Every year you should do this. And what does he want them to do?
And not to your friends to celebrate.
And matanot la'evyonim, right? Portions of food and gifts to the needy. So I want to talk about why we do this and get some insight into the nature of the mitzvah, but it's also its meaning in the book of Esther. So there's a classic halachic question. It comes up in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law. If I send somebody mishloach manot and they refuse them, did I fulfill my mitzvah? For whatever the reason, they refused.
Yes, you performed the mitzvah.
So Ruchama Paskins, yes, I performed the mitzvah. And in fact, that's the view of Rav Moshe Isserles. If you take a look on your sheet, in source number 9, the Rama, V'im sholeach manot l're'ehu v'hu eino rotze l'kabalam, if you send gifts to somebody and they don't want them, or he forgives it. He says, you don't need to send it to me. Don't worry about it. I'm fine. Yatza, you fulfilled your obligation, just like Ruchama suggests.
I was just going to say, the question is the purpose of Mishloach Manot just to do it, or is there an underlying reason that we're doing it, and possibly the joining of two people, so when one refuses it, maybe that hasn't achieved the purpose.
So I'm going to go even further. Maybe the answer is that there are two different ways I could explain the reason for Mishloach Manot. And one reason would seem to be fulfilled this way, and one reason not. Take a look at source number 10, please. The Trumas Hadeshen, a significant halachic authority in early Ashkenaz. Not so early, but he has the question. She'ela. Question. Bnei Adam Hashochem L'Chavereim B'Purim Chalukim Us Dinim U'Chiyai Gavno. Let's say you don't send people food. Let's say you send e-cards. No. Let's say you send clothing, you send blankets to somebody else. Yotzim Yidei Mishloach Manot Olo. So did you fulfill Shalach Manos by doing that? Tshuva. Answer. Yera'ed de'ein yotzim bahen. You do not fulfill your mitzvah that way. Denira de tam de mishloach manot hu kedeshi yehe lekol echad dai v'safek lekayem ha-si'uda kedina. He says the point of mishloach manot is to provide the si'uda. It's to provide the Purim feast, which you don't accomplish if they refuse it. Right? Based on the Trumas Hadeshen, I would say the Rama is incorrect. If I send him a Seuda and he says, I got it covered, not interested, then I have not provided a Seuda for somebody. On the other hand, Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Al-Kabetz, who is best known as the author of what? Someone was muted, I heard. Lachad Dodi, correct. Brother-in-law of Rav Moshe Cordovero. He wrote a commentary to Megillat Esther called Manot Halevi, or Manos Halevi, however you want to do it. He lived in Tzfat in the 16th century, presumably said Manot Halevi. But in any case, he actually, if you read the dedication, he wrote and sent it to his father-in-law as a Purim gift. That was what he did. I gave you the link so you could look it up. In source number 11, right below the title there, I gave you the link so you can see it for yourself. But in any case, look at his version of why we do Mishloach Manot. He says, Osim Yom Yadalit Simcha Mishta V'Yom Tov U'Mishloach Manot Ish L'Oyeyu. We make the 14th day of Adar, a day of joy and feasting and Yom Tov and sending gifts, sending portions, I should say. K'mo Shehaya Inyanam Ki Ish Echad, as they were, as one man. L'Hikahel Kol Echadim Chaveiro, for everybody to gather with everybody else. It's a unity thing. Hefech ish tsar ve'oyev lashon remiyah ha'omer am echad mefuzar. The opposite of what Haman said. Haman said, we are scattered. We are not united. We demonstrate that we are reunited by giving to each other. So Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, says, the Rama is following the Manos Halevi. The point of Mishloach Manot is unity. You increase unity when you send somebody something. Well, that's true, even if they decline. I made a gesture of unity. They said they don't want it. Whatever their motivation is not my problem. I sent it. I reached out. Right? As Rebecca said, the point is to do this, I did it. There's nothing deficient in my act. Whereas the Trumas Hadeshen, Rabbi Isserlein, says no. The point is to provide the feast, and you didn't do that. So that's what the Chasam Sofer suggests. The Chasam Sofer himself was bothered by this idea. He felt that this was inconsistent with other things the Rama said. And the truth of the matter is, it's very hard to accept his argument. Number one, Rabbi Isserlein was a serious halachic authority in Ashkenaz. Rabbi Al-Kabetz was a Kabbalist in Tzfat. The Rama would have been his contemporary. The Rama was Ashkenazi, Rav Al-Kabetz was Sephardi. There's no reason to think that the Rama would have rejected the Trumas Hadeshen, Rabbi Isserlein, in order to adopt the view of Rabbi Al-Kabetz. That's hard to accept. Further, Rabbi Al-Kabetz does not seem to be making a halachic statement in source number 11. He's just explaining, why do we do Mishloach Manot? It's in order to increase unity. He's not making a halachic argument. Not only that, there's a lot of evidence to support the view of Rabbi Isserlein that the point of Shalach Manos is to provide people with their Seuda. Take a look at source number 12, the Rambam. He says, Keitzar chova Seuda zu. What is the obligation for this meal? The Seuda, the Feast of Purim. Sheyocha basar, to eat meat. And sorry to those who are going to have dairy this year because it's Friday and all that, or the vegetarians. He says, to eat meat. V'yitakein Seuda na, and to prepare a nice meal. Kifi asher timtza yada, as one can afford. And in the same halacha, he says, V'chein chayav adam l'shlawach shtei manos shal basar u'shnei minei tavshil u'shnei minei ochlan l'chaveiro, that you send meat, cooked food, or two kinds of food to somebody else. Note there is absolutely no requirement for it to be two different brachos. Please, please do not ever let anyone perpetuate that myth. There is nothing in halacha that says that it has to be two kinds of brachos. The two kinds of food is all that is required. But the point here is, that the Rambam brings the mitzvah of sending shalach manos in the context of sending the meal. What you're doing is providing for the meal. That's all it is. So why did the Rama say what he did? Yes, Susan.
I'm pretty bad. We give Mishloach Manot, but I'm suddenly listening here and saying myself, hey, wait a minute. It's two separate mitzvot. We do Mishloach Manot, but there should be another, the other part of the mitzvah is separate that we give to Evyoni.
Correct. Those are two different mitzvot.
Because most times, most people think of it just as, and now with the e-cards as you're talking about, it's a donation in name of, then we aren't doing the other mitzvot.
Correct. No, they're two completely different mitzvot, and people should fulfill both. Mishloach Manot is food specifically, and Matanot Le'Avyonim is giving to needy people specifically. I would add to that, that giving to an organization which does fine work, but isn't handing your money over to needy people, isn't Matanot Le'Avyonim. It's a nice thing to do, but it's not Matanot Le'Avyonim either.
So which, I mean, I'm not going to go with the street. So Matanot Le'Avyonim.
Let's say Tomchei Shabbos. That's an organization that provides.
Say that in Hebrew, not in your Hebrew.
So no, Tomchei Shabbos is the name. No one ever called them Tomchei Shabbat.
Okay.
That's just not a thing.
No, I didn't get the first word.
Okay, but the rabbis of the shuls do have funds and they tend to distribute. So you could contact.
What about our shuls doing out of the cold? Is that considered food?
So I defer to your halachic authority, to whom you ask halachic questions. But I will put a link in the chat for Tomchei Shabbos, just because it's a known institution supporting people within the community, so I feel comfortable, and it's easy. It's tomchei.ca.
Okay, that would help.
Okay.
Knowing where to do it.
Yeah, I think it's tomchei.ca. Someone else check it while I'm speaking, but I'm pretty sure that that's it. So the question now is this. I have two different explanations being offered for why we do Mishloach Manot. One, to provide the feast. And then I have this other idea about building unity. So Rabbi Usher Weiss, in his Minchas Usher regarding Purim, says, don't read this as a debate. The mitzvah really is to provide a feast, like the Trumas Hadeshen said. Rabbi Al-Kabetz was only adding an explanation for why we provide the feast. We provide the feast in order to build unity. That's all it is. And Rabbi Isserles' ruling, this is in paragraph, in source 13, but I'm not reading it out loud because there are other things I want to get to here. Rabbi Isserles' point in saying that so Janine corrected me. It's in full. It's tomcheishabbos.ca. Tomchei.ca is my mistake. Okay. Thank you, Janine. Rabbi Isserles is saying that the law only requires you to do what you can do. You tried to give a gift. You tried to provide the feast. If they reject it, that's not your problem. That's all that's going on here. You did your best by giving somebody food for the feast. By the way, for that reason though, once we get out of like grade 5, we should stop giving candy. You know, I mean, we can give something that people could actually use to qualify for the Seuda. But in any case, I think this fits the general practice of food sharing for Yom Tov. I come back to the fact that the Megillah describes them doing this spontaneously. You know, the Megillah talks about, yes, thank you, Jeanette. The recipient is in grade 5, you're still okay. So the idea here is that they gave Mishloach Manot before Mordechai told them to. Where did they come up with the idea of doing it spontaneously? The answer is because we actually did this historically for Yom Tov in general. I gave you a reference in source number 14 to verses in Nehemiah. Some of you have seen these with me because I've used them in various occasions. The beginning of this year, I gave my Rosh Hashanah shiur. I talked about what to do when the day is so long and all of that. I mentioned this in that shiur. Those were at my Wednesday morning shiur when I did the socially distanced high holidays. I talked about it as well. When the Jews are gathered for Rosh Hashanah, And they're upset because they realize that they haven't lived up to God's expectations for them, and they're crying. Nehemiah reassures them. He tells them that they should go out and ichlu mashmanim ushtu mamtakim, eat rich foods, drink sweet drinks, vishilchu manot le'ein nachon lo, and give manot, the same word, give manot to those who don't have. They did it for Rosh Hashanah. Not only that, take a look, please, at source number 15 from the time of the Mishnah. The Mishnah, of course, is later than the events in Megillat Esther. Nonetheless, I think it's instructive. The Mishnah is talking about the issue of transporting things on Yom Tov, and the fear that if you send large items to people, you look like you're an Amazon delivery person. That's what they're concerned with in the Mishnah. They're concerned. You start sending a lot of stuff to people on Yom Tov, it looks like it's business. However, take a look at source number 15, where Beit Shammai says, I'm just reading my English in the interest of time, we only send portions of prepared food on Yom Tov. He says, you can send manot, you can send prepared food. And Beit Hillel says, no, all kinds of food can be sent to people on Yom Tov. We send domesticated and wild species of animals and birds, whether they're alive or they're already slaughtered. We send wine, oil, flour, and beans, but not grain. And Rabbi Shimon says you can even send grain. There were practices of sending food to people as a norm on all of the Yamim Tovim. We did it as a Yom Tov celebration. Not only that, I brought it for you in source number 16, but I'll say it outside of the text. The position of Rabbi Avram ibn Daud is that the reason why the sages allowed transporting things on Yom Tov, even though you're not allowed to transport things on Shabbos, was for the sake of enabling people to send gifts of food to each other on Yom Tov, on holidays. That's why the sages said you're allowed to transport things on Yom Tov without an Erev, was in order to enable people to send gifts of food. So my point is this. The Jews of this time would have been very familiar with sending gifts of food as a standard practice for Yom Tov, which makes sense now as to why they took it on as a spontaneous thing for Purim, which Mordechai then enshrines. And that's the idea in Matanot Le'Avyonim as well. As the Mishnah Brura writes, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the money that we give to the needy is also supposed to be to supply the needs of Purim, because you can't send food to everybody, so you have also a mitzvah of sending money. And what this mitzvah accomplishes for the Jews in exile is both Bein Adam LaMakom, between us and God, and in enabling people to thank God for what happened with their feast, and also it's Bein Adam LaChavero, as Rabbi Al-Kabait said, it creates unity among this nation in exile, so that we learn a lesson here about reaching out to others when we are in exile and creating a unified nation to celebrate the Seuda together. That's the idea. Moish has a note. Oh no, Moish sent it to me, so I'm not going to say anything. Okay, sorry. I thought it was to everyone.
I want to go back to you don't have to send two separate brachas.
Yeah. There's no such thing. It came about, I think, because some teacher or teachers wanted to help people to make sure that they would be giving two different foods. So you know it's two different foods if they have two different blessings. But there's no requirement whatsoever that it should be two different blessings. None whatsoever. So what I want to do next week is talk about who wrote this book, who is the author of Megillat Esther. Susan's been waiting since week one for us to have that conversation.
Not next week.
No, next week. Next
week. This week we miss.
We're not missing any weeks. Shmuel is off, but Tuesday, yeah, Tuesday continues. I want to talk about who wrote the book. I want to talk about the tax of Achashverosh in chapter 10 and why we need to end the Megillah by saying Achashverosh issued a tax over the land. And of course, you have to conclude the Megillah by talking about Mordechai being beloved to Rov Echav. Is that to most of his brothers? What happened to everybody else? So we'll probably have some thought on that as well. And then we're going to move into the book of Ruth. So thank you everybody very much. And I wish you a Purim Sameach.
And
a Purim. Yes, Rebecca.
You mentioned Ruth, and I will mention again next week. We will be sending out an email, but if you know anybody,